Hello and welcome to the Inform Podcast. This is episode number, hold on a second. I'm going to open up my web browser and take a look at the web page because I know it's 40 something, but I don't know which 40. It's 48, episode number 48 of the Inform Podcast. Hi, how are you? Hello, everybody. You are listening to the Inform Podcast. This is episode number 48. And today, for this section of the podcast anyways, you only have me. You only have the Neil half of the Inform Podcast. Jared, the cat's meow of the podcasting world, is out today. And as a result, you have me for a little bit. And then after I'm done talking to you on my own, you're going to hear an interview that I did with somebody who is a friend of both Jared and myself, a person named Winnie. It'll be an interview on her experience of entering into this very weird process that we call psychoanalysis. However, before jumping into that interview, what I wanted to do is kind of contextualize a little bit and I suppose try to set it up, but just a little bit here. To do that, I'm going to make a claim. The claim that I'm going to make is that psychoanalysis is something which a lot of people right now who call themselves analysts are trying, I think, very hard to make more available to more people. Be that as it may, all of those analysts that I just mentioned who are working hard to make analysis more available to more people also, by and large, do not believe that psychoanalysis is a process for everybody. So I want to try to say this a little bit more succinctly here. Most analysts that I happen to know, and definitely me as well, as I'm speaking as an analyst here, as somebody who practices psychoanalysis, tend to believe that it would be good if psychoanalysis was available to a larger number of people. And at the same time, we also believe that psychoanalysis is not something which is necessarily for every single person. There are some people who, if they seek out an analyst, they enter into analysis and they stick with it for a long enough time, they'll get something interesting, cool, possibly life-changing out of it. That will happen. And there'll be other people who, if they entered into psychoanalysis, they would detest it, they would hate it, they would loathe it, and they probably wouldn't get that much out of it. If you're somebody or you know people who are in the first group of people, great. Psychoanalysis is something that I hope you find a way to try. Be that as it may, I want to make this super clear. If you're somebody who's in that second group of people, or you know people who are in that second group of people, trying to force them to get psychoanalysis or convince them to get psychoanalysis, I don't think that that's a necessarily great idea. So that's the first thing that I wanted to say. Having said that, what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about the person who you're about to hear in this interview. Winnie is somebody who I first met when I was teaching. She took a class of mine. She expressed an interest in psychoanalysis. We got to talking about it. Eventually, she graduated from the program that I teach in, and she's gone out into the world and, you know, started to become a successful mental health practitioner. And recently-ish, she got in touch with me and said, "Hey, can you help me find an analyst?" And I was like, "I'd be happy to help you find an analyst." And I said, "You know, how far are you willing to travel?" And she told me something like, "Oh, I'm willing to drive like, you know, 40 minutes or something like that to go see an analyst." And I told her that if she wanted to only drive 40 minutes to see an analyst, that she'd be coming to see me, which is something that she didn't want to do because we're friends now, right? Like, I mean, Winnie and I have become friends over the years that we've known each other. And it's not necessarily a good idea or super advisable to become a psychoanalyst for people who you are friends with, right? And so we talked about that, and I made a referral for her to go see a different analyst, and that's what she did. So I think if you know that, you probably know everything that you need to know in order to understand the stuff that we talk about in this interview. It's a fairly short interview. Winnie, both Winnie and I have small children. And when we did this interview, we ended up having a pretty small window of time to do it. And so we made the most of our time and we talked about the process of entering psychoanalysis. So I'm going to play some transition music here. And when we come back from that transition music, you will be hearing my interview with Winnie about entering psychoanalysis. All right, this is the InForm podcast. My name is Neil, and normally I am joined by the cat's meow of the podcasting world, Jared. But today, Jared is not here. He had other things that needed his attention and his meows. However, I am joined by somebody else. I am joined today by somebody who's named Winnie. And Winnie and I are going to talk about the process of entering into analysis. But I'll let you introduce yourself, Winnie. Why don't you say hello to the listeners, tell them a little bit about you, and in particular, tell them maybe why it is that you're interested in talking about the process of entering into analysis.
Great. Hi. As Neil said, my name is Winnie, and I am not Jared, unfortunately, for many of the listeners. Hopefully, I will fill in his very large shoes today. I am a master's of social work working on getting my license. And I have another year of supervision until that happens. And in this process of getting my master's and ultimately my license analysis, and psychoanalysis has been for me a way to understand and interpret, how to approach this thing called social work that I am attempting to do and engage with other people. It's given me some context to understanding ways of being and ways of interacting with others, which I think very naturally correlates into the social work world. And I wanted to talk about psychoanalysis because it's such a, you know, my personal psychoanalysis and beginning the process is a critical element of psychoanalysis itself. So I felt like I had things to share.
That's a perfect introduction. Thank you for doing that. So I want to do a little bit of clearing up for people who maybe are a little bit unfamiliar with this. Not a whole lot of time on this, but Winnie mentioned that she's got a master's in social work, an MSW. To be a social worker, to have a license to do social work in the United States, in most states, you need to have a master's degree. You have that. And then the thing that happens after people get their master's degree is they tend to go out into the field and do work somewhere, or in some cases, in multiple places. And they do that for about 2 years. And during those 2 years, they get clinical supervision from somebody who has a clinical license. And after that, they can take a test. And if they pass the test, then they can actually earn their clinical license. So if I heard you correctly, just so to make sure that we get this contextually correct, you are 1 year out from getting your master's degree, 1 year into doing the work that you're doing and getting the supervision. You have about a year left before you're going to go through the process of getting that clinical license, which would ultimately enable you to see patients individually on a one-to-one basis. If you wanted to bill insurance, you could do that sort of thing.
Yes, perfectly said.
All right, great. And what's interesting here is that you think that using psychoanalysis might be something that you'll do, you know, through like both where you are now, I'm guessing, and eventually in your future as well. And you said that if somebody wants to do that, if somebody is interested in making use of psychoanalysis as a technical practice, not just as a theory that you use to think about the world, although it's useful for that, but to use it as a clinical practice, one of the things that people tend to do is they get their own analysis. And this is something that you're doing right now. So why don't we start with that? Why don't you talk about how it is that you maybe became interested in getting your own analysis, and then from there maybe bounce into how you went about finding an analyst, contacting that person, and starting the process up.
Where to begin? How did I become interested in finding a psychoanalyst? Was how, well, mostly we spend time, and this is something that others might not know, we spend time talking regularly. I talk with Neil and sometimes Jared and others who are interested in psychoanalysis about the theories of psychoanalysis and some of the content has come to be today. So it has made a long progression from where it began. And in all of those conversations, one of the things that has been made very clear to me as someone who's interested in psychoanalysis as a conceptual and ultimately potentially clinical part of my professional experience is that one of the things that's required is that you have to experience it, which I like on all sorts of levels, because I feel like it's helpful to have that sort of understanding of what's happening if you're going to be engaging with that with another person. So I was interested in it both because my curiosity was piqued from an intellectual level about psychoanalysis, and because I felt like when it was explained to me and as I continue to read it, it seems like something that might be of value, because it was a value to me. It might be a value to others. But I was very intimidated by the process. I was not enthusiastic to run out and acquire my own psychoanalysis because it seemed incredibly intimidating. You know, my appreciation or my understanding of it before I went in was a little bit, and I think it's a trepidation that a lot of people have relative to just therapy, which is the vulnerability of exposing oneself in these ways where you're being really honest, not just the like fake authentic honest. and I was intimidated by that because, for all of the reasons that I think I feel might be identifiable, which is that, you know, sometimes we worry about what we have to offer, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was very thoughtful. It took me a while to get excited to go to psychoanalysis. And even when I made that first appointment, I don't think that excitement was a word that I would use. It was like, okay, readiness, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I think the other word that I would use to describe my preparation for psychoanalysis and I think is relevant here was that I anticipated that it would be destabilizing. And I anticipated that because that was a conversation that we have had in talking about, you know, clinical psychoanalysis, is that sort of the point of it is to go to a space, or it could be the point of it is to go to a space where you are ultimately destabilized a bit. Your identities are pushed. And I like my identities. I have acquired them over, 40 years or so. So I didn't think that that sounded great. But sometimes I also feel like the things that are the most helpful are sometimes a little bit painful. Mm-hmm. Or they can be. I mean, I don't want to make a blanket generalization there, but, sometimes in order to make growth or acquire the things that you're looking for, it does mean that you will have to go through something a little bit difficult to get there. So once I made peace with the fact that that was what was going to happen, I got in contact with Neil, actually, who goes through the Lacanian compass. And I said, I'm looking for a psychoanalyst in the, I live in Chicago. So I gave a very specific area within Chicago that I was looking for, assuming that I would have a 15-minute at most trek to find the nearest psychoanalyst. And that was not exactly what happened. So I can tell you, I sent that out to Neil, and Neil said, okay, well, that's me or no one, basically. Mm-hmm. And then I thought about that a little bit, and I was looking for a little bit more, anonymity in my psychoanalysis from the beginning. So I actually made a trek to Omaha, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. To meet with the psychoanalyst who is a renowned Lacanian psychoanalyst there, who has written many books and has a lot of experience with it. So I think that answers the questions that you had so far.
Yeah, that's a great way to get started. I want to zero in on a couple of the things that you said and maybe unpack them a bit more, though. So the first thing is this the idea of identity and the idea of our identities being destabilized or kind of brought, not assumed to be as stable as we might think they are in our day-to-day lives, which I think is something that happens in the vast majority of psychoanalysis that people engage in. I've been thinking about this lately for a couple of different reasons. And one of them is that I'm getting ready to teach again in the fall. And this has been something that has been hard for me to teach about when I do teach about psychoanalysis, because I find that many of the students who I'm teaching have a very similar reaction to the one you described. They think, why would I go through something that questions my identity? You know, my identity is such a huge part of who I am. And I've been starting to play around with the idea of saying to people that identity is a really useful thing. I mean, in the Lacanian framework, our identity is very much in the register of the imaginary. It's the way that we imagine ourselves to be, which is not necessarily the way that we are, but it's how we think we are. It's the story we tell ourselves and others about ourselves. And it's a way of, I've started to think of this identity maybe as a platform that we can stand on when we talk. And part of what psychoanalysis does is it helps us to maybe recognize that that platform is not as solid as we have previously imagined and assumed it to be, right? It doesn't say that the platform is bad. It doesn't say that it's stupid. It doesn't say that you shouldn't have it. It just says that platform, don't be so sure, ultimately. So I kind of wanted to give you that description and see what you thought about that, this idea of identity as something which is already not as structurally sound as we think, and engaging in a process that might help identify some of the weak points in that platform that we stand upon.
So first I want to talk about the first thing that you said was that some of the students that you're coming across have a similar response that I did, which is that they don't want to push on that identity. And I'm going to have to reflect on that a little bit, because in a lot of my conversations with others, I haven't found them. And of course you're doing this more frequently, so I'm curious to hear more. I haven't found necessarily that the concern is that they are conscious that they have an identity that is going to be destabilized. That I found it sort of a different entry point for their concern.
Yeah, that I think that that's fair. I think that one of the things that's happening in classrooms for me a lot now is the idea of identity, in particular identity through things like race, gender, class, etc., has taken on an incredibly privileged position. And almost, I would go so far as to call it sacred position. Right? This thing that you're not supposed to question. If somebody says my identity is whatever, mm-hmm. you're supposed to say, good for you. You claim that identity and that is you. And I think that in the way that I kind of have experienced psychoanalysis, and I'd say the way that I practice it, that's not my reaction to identity. My reaction to identity is, don't be so sure. And that's not the commonplace, I think, way of engaging identity nowadays, right? And so when I talk about people having, I guess, a trepidation or a uneasiness around psychoanalysis or anything probably that has that reaction to their proclaimed identity and the politics that come with that identity, that's kind of what I'm referring to. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I will also say on a more personal note that I go to psychoanalysis. I go on my little adventure, I get on a plane and I fly to Omaha, and I have multiple sessions in one day, and it's very much an experience, which I sort of thought was fun, you know. And I think that the things that have settled with me, or the things that I've continued to think about, are just how prepared I was to explain my identity to my psychoanalyst. Like, these are the things I've really thought about it a lot, you know, because this is not my first foray into therapy. I'm an adult. I've been living with myself for quite a long time. So I've really created a lot of thoughts about my experiences, and I was very ready to share all of those. Mm-hmm. But the most interesting portion of the psychoanalysis, or the one that has sat with me the longest and is easily the most frustrating, is the one where I had a slip, where I said something. And for those that don't know, I'm sure that many of us do, but I said something that I didn't intend to say. And I was very quickly schooled, and I said, I didn't mean that. And I was very quickly reminded that, well, actually, that's the point of being here, is to point out those things that you thought that you didn't mean, but that maybe you do. And it's the one that I've thought about the most. And maybe, you know, again, maybe we don't, it's still just a starting point of a conversation on another level.
Yeah. I think that's a great example of that, right? You know, you stand on the platform. I mean, one of the identities that a person can have is an analyst. You know, I am somebody who wants to do psychoanalysis. Look at me. Mm-hmm. And I'm so self-aware, and I'm interested in becoming even more self-aware, and I'm going to, you know, I know I have defensives, but I'm ready to take those defenses on. And I'm talking a lot about me when I speak in this kind of disparaging way, because that's how I was. I don't know if that's how you were, but that's how I was. And the same thing, right? You go into analysis and eventually you do exactly what you said. You say something unexpected. It comes out in a way that you didn't expect it to come out. And the analyst notices it and highlights it, draws your attention to what you have just said. And the reaction is, yeah, but I didn't mean it like that. I didn't mean that. And then there's this point where it's like, sure, of course you didn't, but that's what you said. You know, and it does. It starts the process, right? Which I've sometimes called the paranoid machinery of interpretation, that you take with you out of that office, and it stays with you for a while. I don't know, I think that that's actually a really interesting thing. So I think that's a beautiful example.
Yeah, I've been trying to understand it, you know, since it happened. I mean, it's been sort of after the dust settled, it's been, you know, the paranoid machinery is a good example or a good way of describing it. You know, you can feel the mechanisms working it to try and find a place for it, I think, is what I naturally do, is what trying to find an explanation, I think. And I think that that's really valuable. I'm still trying to understand why I'm trying to do that and what the explanation is.
Yeah, that's good. I think it's use the word destabilize. And I think what you're describing and what I just kind of termed the paranoid machinery of interpretation is an effect of that destabilization. It makes you kind of go like, wait a minute, did I mean that? Right? As opposed to when you're stable, air quote stable, I think people kind of just go through their life operating within a fantasy that they speak what they mean, that they have something that they want to communicate, they put it into words, and it is communicated largely in the way that they have intended it to be. And they just sort of like go through life like that. They don't think about it all that much. And then when you go into this really weird thing called psychoanalysis, there's these instances where you attempt to communicate and something is communicated, but it sure isn't what you thought you were communicating, or it's not the way that you thought you were doing it. And then you're like, wait a minute, how do I do this in other parts of my life too? Have I been wrong all along? Have I been like overplaying my hand and assuming that I was a much more effective communicator? Whoa, you know, it does that to you. And that's that thing that, I don't know, I can understand that not everybody would want to expose themselves to that effect. But there are some people who do, and they find it both destabilizing or unsettling, but also useful, I think, right? I get the impression from the way that you're describing it that you're one of those people who would fall into the latter group. You do find it like a little bit jarring, but at the same time, you're going back and you're doing it again. So there's something of value in that for you.
Well, I think you have to, this is where I'm at right now. You know, you have a couple of choices about what you can do with that information. You know, you can either say, no, you're wrong. I meant to come to this place where you feel confident that what you said is what you meant, and that it's, you know, there's no doubt in that. Or you can actualize or realize that maybe there was something else that you needed or were looking for, and that was incredibly helpful to achieve that. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. So let's pick on that for a second here too. Another thing that you said is that the way that you're doing analysis is that you'll get on a plane somewhere in Chicago, you fly to Omaha, you do several sessions in a day. And, you know, this is something that happens in the Lacanian world, I find, right? My analysis started the same way that yours did, because we go to the same analyst. And so I'm familiar with what that was like for me to get on a plane, take my body from Chicago to Omaha, grab an Uber, get to this guy's office, you know, so on and so forth. And I'm really curious, what do you think? Do you think it's important to do that? Do you think it's important to actually take your body? And I'm asking this question because we live in a time when it's really easy to, air quotes, meet somebody by opening up your computer and using something like Zoom to have a session with people. And there's a lot of mental health practitioners that are having their sessions through Zoom and have been doing that for the last year rather regularly. And, you know, that's one way to do this. Do you think there's something important about actually physically taking your real body from point A to point B and finding yourself at point B with another person in a room?
I feel like there are a lot of answers to that question. My understanding of psychoanalysis as it has been presented to me is that it is necessary. I absolutely needed to be in the same room as my psychoanalyst, that it was very important for me and for reasons that I'm still fleshing out. I think there's something so valuable about that connection. I think that we communicate not just verbally, but through our nonverbals. And I think that's something that's missing when you're using a Zoom session. I don't necessarily think that that means that there is no space for Zoom or for a virtual session. But I think when you are getting to know an analyst, when you're getting to know someone who their purpose is to be in a room with you and observe and comment, you know, that to actually be with them is important. So yes, I do think that it was critical for me. I do think that it's incredibly valuable. I don't want to say that again, that there's no room for the virtual session as well, but mm-hmm. I think that the in-person meeting just is important.
Yeah. I mean, I asked that question because this is going to be maybe a weird aside. So and maybe we'll go deep down it and maybe not, but there's a really interesting book that I have just started reading this summer. It's called The Analyst's Desire, and it's by a guy named Mitchell Wilson, if anybody cares. And in this book, the second chapter of the book, he makes this really interesting metaphor that I've been thinking a lot about. And it's a metaphor of psychoanalyst as innkeeper. And the way that he says is that, you know, people travel to the psychoanalyst's office. They're on a path in their life, and that path takes them by this place, or maybe they have to take a slight detour to get there. So they, you know, as in the case of flying to Omaha, so they do that. And when somebody actually, you know, kind of stops at this place, when they bring their body to the inn, and the innkeeper can say, "Why have you traveled here? You know, why have you traveled to this place?" And he thinks that it's that you have to be able to ask that question sort of like in a real legitimate way, i.e. the person does need to have traveled to come see you. And he says that this is all just like another way of thinking about the beginning of a therapeutic process or a psychoanalytic process, where you say to your patient or your analyst, "So what brought you to see me? You know, why are you doing this? Why now?" Those different questions. And his way of thinking of that is, why have you gone to the trouble to do this? Why have you gone to the trouble of traveling to this place? And that is a question that takes on a very different, I think, meaning if you have literally traveled to that place versus if you have, you know, walked into a room somewhere in your house and popped open your laptop, right? Which isn't to say that that's not useful or helpful. I think that it's both useful and helpful to do telehealth in lots of instances, but it's not the same as actually traveling to a place in that way. So anyways, that was my thing. Again, whatever that makes you think, I'd be very interested in hearing your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, first I want to say I like it. My first reaction. It evokes a lot of images of that experience for me. And also it just sounds sort of oddly comforting. And I think it goes back to, you know, the accountability that we take for going to something or going through this process and the thought process that we go through sort of like psychoanalysis in general, is are you willing to think through why it is and what it is that you're doing? And are you willing to take the accountability for that thought process? And so when you ask the question, you know, why are you here? You know, I think that's, it's an incredibly important question. You know, people, I think, will sometimes say, well, because I'm mad, or I'm, you know, it's like, well, let's think about that a little bit more thoroughly, maybe. I do like the, you know, the romanticism of the innkeeper having also gone to, you know, to travel. So that's wonderful. It also reminds me a little bit of the process of determining what you're willing to pay, you know, which is a critical element of psychoanalysis as well.
Could you say more about that? Like, why, to call it a critical element, which I agree it is, why do you say that? And what do you mean when you say that?
Well, there are a lot of different reasons why, I think. I think one of the most accessible or the earliest ones is that, you know, you have to make that determination outside of a third party. So this is an engagement that you're having with another person outside of traditional insurance related benefits, because that additional third party interference has an impact on the relationship that you built with your psychoanalyst. Because there are, you know, there are different regulations or different thought processes that are sort of being impressed upon the experience. Additionally, you know, it's also a matter of what is the value conversation and the inherent way in which we evaluate things that have meaning for us, you know, and people are willing to spend a lot of money on going to the gym and on buying new things that make them feel better. But to have an experience where you actually are reevaluating the way in which you live, putting value on that is just an interesting thought process. It's just an interesting experiment in your own values, I think.
Definitely. It, as you say that, the association that comes to my mind is, there's another podcast I listen to, The Ezra Klein Show. And Ezra Klein is a columnist for the New York Times. And one of the things that he does in many of his interviews is he'll ask a sort of rhetorical question to people, because he's talking to like economists and sociologists and policy bigwigs and stuff. And he's like, what do you think would be the effect if we were to pay social workers who work with individuals who struggle with addiction, you know, $100,000 a year? What if the starting salary, you know, for somebody doing that was $100,000? Or if he doesn't use a social worker working with an addict, he might say, what if you take like a elementary school teacher in a public school, and you say that they get as their starting salary $100K per year? He's like, what kind of an effect do you think that would have? And he says that he asked this question because he's trying to make people kind of consciously consider the extent to which we do not value those kinds of professions the way that we do some other things. Klein's argument is that one of the ways that we measure value in our society, in our culture, is by how much we pay people for the things that they do. The people who get the most amount of money tend to have the highest value. And he thinks it's really kind of strange and odd that people who don't actually do things that are truly all that valuable very often get a ton of money, right? Like, I mean, being really good at basketball, you can make a lot of money doing that, right? Now, does that produce a huge amount of value for the society you live in, or for individual people? No, it doesn't. It's entertaining, it has entertainment value, but it's not the same kind of value that you would get from, you know, perhaps working with a very competent mental health professional. And yet, competent mental health professionals are often, you know, struggling a lot to make the amount of money they need to make in order to meet their various financial obligations, like student loans, rent, mortgage, so on and so forth. So it is a really important component of the process. I would definitely agree.
Yeah. Yes, to all of those things. There's a contrarian in me that wants to say something like, Michael Jordan brought a lot of joy. I don't know. But I won't, because I don't actually mean that. I'm just teasing. I mean, I do mean that. But
look at that. Look at that. You just did a joke, and a joke is a great example of a formation of your unconscious happening right here, right now. Look at that.
Oh, busted. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I do. I agree with your previous statement. Yes. And I think it's, again, back to what I said previously, I think it's a critical part of the process of evaluating what you really care about.
Yeah. I think that, you know, this is one of the interesting things too, is that, one of the things that makes that difficult, I think, is that there are some people who truly don't have a lot of money. They don't. And it's not a matter of having the money and not wanting to spend it on this thing. It's a matter of not having the money to spend. And those are the people who a lot of times I think just would say psychoanalysis is not an option for me. And so I don't know, maybe this is just a me idea that I feel compelled to talk about, but I think it's important to do what we can to help and to make psychoanalysis available to people who it isn't always available to. And to do that, we also have to, you know, charge what it's actually worth for the people who have the capacity to pay what it's actually worth. That's a really important component of this work, I would say. And it's interesting because it sounds to me like, I don't know if starting analysis changed the way that you think about that or didn't, or if you thought about it that way already, and then you just went into analysis with those thoughts in your mind. So I guess I ask that question. Did it change the way that you think about the fee and the setting of the fee when you yourself were on the receiving end of that as an analysand?
Well, what I will say about that is that I think that, you know, this experience, this process, and these conversations create new ways for you to practice out the things that you find interesting. You know, sometimes it's a matter of not knowing what exists, not knowing what options are out there. And I think that sounds a little bit like an excuse, like, oh, I didn't know that I could do this, you know, and now my world has opened and now I can, you know, if you know, I struggle with that because I think, oh, well, if it was really important to me, I would have fought for it. I would have found a way to make it happen, you know, but when you have that experience and when it's put in front of you, you know, it's perspective building. And so I have a new perspective on how I can approach things. And it's something that I've learned that I appreciate. And I can say that, you know,
So this is a big question, and you can totally decline to answer it if you don't want to. But, one of the things that I've will think about a lot when I work with people as analysands is something that Freud said. And I wish I could remember where he said this. I think he said it at one point. He might've said it in the United States during the time he was here for the Clark lectures, but I'm not 100% sure. Regardless, the thing is that psychoanalysis is something that helps people love and work. That's what he said. You know, it's a practical way to feel better is what Lacan said later on. And I like that too. And so when somebody has started to go through psychoanalysis, when somebody has, you know, taken the steps that you've taken to start this very interesting, kind of weird thing called psychoanalysis, have you noticed that it has an impact on your life in other ways? You know, has it impacted your life in ways outside of the consulting room, i.e. has it changed the way that you love/, you know, relate to other people, and the way that you work, you know, which we spend so much of our time working that's actually a really important thing. So have you noticed that those effects kind of early on in the process?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, the conversation that we were starting to have in the beginning, talking about identity in this conversation now, just again, and also in terms of perspective building, it helps you to appreciate that, you know, particularly in terms of work, I'll talk about that specifically, you know, if you want to do something that's helpful, and we've had this conversation before in other ways, or you find the work that you're doing to be, you know, this thing that you're having difficulty doing because you're not excited about it because it's not bringing you a ton of joy, right? You know, it helps to put perspective on, I guess I'll use the word reframing, which isn't necessarily a psychoanalytic word, but reframing the way in which you go about it, you know, or that you think about it, or you understand the purpose of it and the things that you have to do and the things that you want to do and the way in which you spend your time. So I think it's brought perspective to me in a lot of different ways relative to the way that I work in particular, and how I want to go about that and what I want my days to look like, and how I want to appreciate my ability to even have an opportunity to do certain things. So I can say that. And in terms of love, you know, I think that's a different question. And I'm feeling that it's reinforcing for me some of the positive choices that I've made. And it's actually helping me to, I think, I should probably ask my people whom I'm attempting to love whether or not they feel this way, but it's helping me to do that in a way that might be more meaningful for them. You know, because I think that's another thing that we sometimes bring to the table is our own perception of what that should look like. And, you know, having an appreciation for doing that in a way that feels fulfilling for those that we're sharing with. So,
yeah, that's an interesting answer. As you were kind of saying that, one of the thoughts that popped into my mind is that this is sort of trying to take us full circle. We have an identity, I think. Our work identity, our professional identity that we've constructed for however long we've been doing whatever we do. And we have, I think, our identity that we have cultivated in concert with the people who are a huge part of our lives, right? And, you know, we started this conversation talking about the ways that that identity might not be as stable or as accurate or whatever as we think it is in our head, and that perhaps psychoanalysis alerts us to some of those things, those inconsistencies in our identity, and that can have a really interesting, I think, impact on the ways that we love and the ways that we work. You know, that if you don't ever have the experience of questioning those identities and the kind of structure of them, seeing where they're not as stable as we think they are, you're just going to go through life assuming that your identity is the, you know, the way that you are, that you mean what you say, so on and so forth. And this process can help you realize, oh, wait a minute, not so much actually. Huh. A story I tell myself about my job, not as accurate as I once assumed it was. I don't know. Does that make sense to you as I say it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it does. And yes.
The other thing that I guess I had kind of hanging out in my head here is bouncing back to the metaphor of the innkeeper, and the question that starts off the analytic process. So why are you doing this? You know, I think it's a really important question. It's really interesting. I look back at my own experience, and when I first started to go to psychoanalysis, one of the ways that I answer that question is I'm doing this because I want to be a psychoanalyst. And that was like my answer. And it was funny because the analyst who I said that to was like, okay, that's an interesting answer. And you know, that the word interesting can mean like anything in the world, right? It could mean that's stupid, or it could mean that that's a fascinating answer. You don't know what it means. It's a great equivoque in that way. But it's funny because when I went in, I thought that's why I was going, right? I really did. And I was sure that there were other reasons too, but I couldn't say what they were. And then now that I've gone for years, a lot of the actual reasons why I bothered traveling to Omaha to start the process of analysis have become a little bit more present in my life. There's something that I can consider in new and interesting ways. And this is a weird way to set up a question here, right? Did you find that when you were going into analysis, starting it off, that you were trying to kind of prepare your answer for why are you doing this? And, you know, what was that like? Did you, when you went in sort of with your prepared answer, if you don't mind telling people, what happened?
Yeah, that's funny that you asked that because you had actually shared that experience that you had gone in and you had said that. And I had the thought at that moment, oh man, what am I going to say? Because Neil took my answer, you know, or took my question, because that literally would have been why I had gone in. So then I had to reevaluate and re-prepare something new, you know, and it's the same thought process, even though it was a different question or a different way of presenting, the thought was, still being overly prepared for this thing, right? And I still said, you know, I'm here because I want to be a psychoanalyst, you know? And then we laugh about how that's not a real thing. But it's still true. It's still true. I still want to learn how to be a psychoanalyst. And I understand and appreciate on some levels what that really means and, you know, the dangers of that or the pitfalls. Mm-hmm. But yes, I came armed with this is why I'm here. These are the, you know, and I had sort of like a couple of like, well, and I have a couple issues that I'll throw out there just so that I can, you know, seem as though I'm being particularly forthcoming. Mm-hmm. And those were, you know, as you would expect, or perhaps as you would expect, they were non conversation starters, you know, because they were not something that was coming from what I was actually feeling and thinking at the time. So,
You know, this is, it's interesting for me to talk with you about this because I don't want to go too deeply into this. So I'm going to be circumspect in the way that I described this interaction. And I'm very aware of that. But, in my first session of psychoanalysis, I was talking about myself and trying to sort of like give the analyst a highlights reel, I guess, you know, like here are some important things from my life that I've lived through. And I ended up talking about my fear of dying and the way that that kind of manifests in my life. And one of the ways that it manifests in my life, it tends to come up when I'm going to sleep, when I don't have anything else to distract me. I'm like, literally there's, I'm just lying there, right? Not doing anything, hoping that sleep will arrive and it'll hit me where it's like, you know, this awareness of my own mortality will come up and it jolts me awake and makes it very difficult to sleep. And so I mentioned this in the very first session of analysis and it was commented upon. And then a long time went by, and by a long time, I mean like excess of 2 years. And, I don't know exactly how much longer, but longer than 2 years. And 2 years later, I was talking about something and it sparked a memory from when I was a kid. And I shared this and it was one of my first experiences of death as a kid. And I shared this, it just came up, you know, unintended, unexpected. I didn't know I was going to talk about it or whatever. It just did. And the analyst was able to make a connection between what I said in session number one, the very first time that I came and bothered to take myself to go see this particular person and talk in this particular way. And this thing that came up like however many, you know, 22 months later or something like that. Right. It was wild. It was really wild. And I guess I bring that up. It's straying from the topic of beginning analysis, but I wanted to toss that in because I think it's important to say explicitly that analysis is a process that is not fast, right? It does take time and you can't like speed it along. It happens at whatever pace it happens. And if people stick with it, if they start it, which you have to start it to have anything happen, but if you start it, and I believe if people stick with it, eventually they might have their version of that moment that I just described where something from kind of like comes up and you're able to connect it in this weird and interesting way. And that led to a whole bunch of other things like later on. It actually, I talked about this in the previous episode of the show. Sometimes I think of analysis as like a three-act structure. Like act one is like kind of just sort of feeling it out and figuring out how to free associate. Act two is free associating and kind of constructing new forms of meaning that are helpful. In act three is like analysis where you encounter something which doesn't make sense and you can't make it make sense no matter how much you try. And yet it still has this enormous place in your life and you start to engage with that in a different way. But, it's really interesting because you have to start to go through those other things. So again, that was a weird thing. I said all that. What do you think about any of that, including like, that was boring, dude. Like, why did you talk about it?
No, I think it's exciting. But the thing that I think is, you know, very selfish. And my first thought process is I have such a hard time with that because I want things now. To your point of, you know, the minute that you stopped moving is when the feelings of mortality would rise. You know, I think that's pretty relatable for most people, whether it's conscious or not, is that we keep moving, you know, and we want to do things quickly. And I'm sure that for many of us that is because we're trying to avoid that feeling of our own mortality. You know, as if we don't stop, then, you know, we don't notice and we don't feel it. And so when we say things take a long time, that's hard for me. It is. It's just hard for me. I speak quickly. I think quickly. I move quickly. It's hard. But I think, again, back to the perspective building, is that sometimes those things that are hard are the things that you might need, you know? And in the minimal experiences that I've had in a clinical setting with others, I think that seems to be a recurring theme for everyone. That's what it makes me think of. It makes me think, yes, and also, oh no. You know.
All right. Well, I know that we're kind of coming up to the end of the time that we had set aside to have this conversation. There's still more to say. There always is. But I'll let you have the last word here, Winnie. Do you have anything that you wanted to say, anything that you wanted to ask, any claims that you wanted to make? And we'll end on whatever note it is you'd like to end on.
Wow, that's a lot of pressure. I think that the psychoanalytic experience, even though I was prepared for it by having conversations about what it would look like and feel like, and that I thought about it excessively in advance, was not what I anticipated. And I think it's one of those things, just like so many things, that, you know, is going to be different than what you expect. And if you allow it to just do what it's meant to do, that can be helpful or beneficial for you.
Perfect. Thank you very much for taking the time to have this conversation. I appreciate it. And this is it. You know, maybe we'll have more conversations like this in the future. I hope that Winnie, you'll be willing to come back and talk about more things. But until next time, everybody, thank you very much for having us in your ears. Make glorious mistakes. Don't let the man keep you down. So on and so forth. We will talk again soon.